Hack the Entrepreneur is part of Rainmaker FM, the digital business podcast network. Find more great shows and education at rainmaker.fm. I want to thank today's sponsor, 3DCart. They're one of the first e-commerce platforms to hit the market, and for over 18 years, they have pioneered the e-commerce industry. And they have made it so starting an online business has never been easier. With our very special offer, you can try 3DCart for free for an entire month. Go to 3dcart.com/hack. That's the number 3dcart.com/hack. That's a Hack the Entrepreneur listener. You'll get the first month free.
Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me again today. I'm your host, John Naster, but you can call me Johnny. My guest today has been writing on the internet since 1982. And Tim Ferriss calls him the most interesting man in the world. He has spent the past 40 years living project to project and accomplishing some truly impressive feats in the process without ever attending college or university. From 1984 to 1990, he was the publisher and editor of the Whole Earth Review. My guest is also a world-renowned best-selling author of countless books. His latest book is The Inevitable. He is also the author of the viral internet piece called 1,000 True Fans. Now, let's hack. Kevin Kelly. Are you ready to start selling online but don't know the next steps? Now you can sell easily, quickly, and securely with 3DCart. 3DCart is everything you need to sell online. Creating, designing, and managing your e-commerce store has never been so easy. The 3DCart platform boasts hundreds of built-in features, point-of-sale system, a powerful admin panel, optimized checkout, over 100 professionally designed and responsive themes, plus 24/7, 365 free technical support and competitive pricing to meet any business's budget. Yes, even yours. Starting an online business has never been easier. Use 3DCart online store builder and shopping cart software to easily build an online store right the first time. And with our special offer, you can try 3DCart for free for an entire month to experience all of the shopping cart's software and powerful and intuitive features. With zero transaction fees and countless advanced features, it is absolutely no surprise that 3DCart continues to dominate the e-commerce market. Best of all, it's available for a low monthly price. Try 3DCart for free and get started in seconds. Just go to 3dcart.com/hack. As a Hack the Entrepreneur listener, you will get your very first month absolutely free. That's 3dcart.com/hack to start selling today. And we are back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. And today we have a very, very, very special guest. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, absolutely my pleasure. Well, let's jump right into it, Kevin. I know you are a man of many, many things. You wear many hats. You've done many things. But today we're talking to Kevin Kelly, the entrepreneur. So, Kevin, could you tell me, as an entrepreneur, what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
I am not afraid to ask a dumb question. That has gotten me further than anything else. I've always done it, even as a kid. And there are several things that happen from that. One is always, everyone will tell me later, oh, I'm so glad you asked that question. I was thinking the same thing, but I was too embarrassed to ask. And then secondly, that's how I learn. You know, communicating is really difficult for anybody. And many people who know a lot are not necessarily the best communicators. And so asking questions is actually an assist to them. They actually need it sometimes. They actually want it sometimes. And so, and then, you know, it's a great way to find out how to do stuff. And for me, the only way to really learn something besides trying is to actually press on the question side and really make sure that I do understand it. And so asking the dumb question is the thing that I've learned is the best way for me to do that.
I love it. Do you think that you ask yourself the dumb questions too?
I try to. And by the way, that's what writing is for me. I write in order to figure out what I think, because I don't know what I think until I write it. Or I think I know, then I start to write it and realize, oh, I don't know. So I have to ask myself these dumb questions. And one of the questions I ask myself all the time when I'm writing is, do I really believe that? Is that really what I think? Is that really true? Does that really make sense if I was, if I was a skeptic? And so I think for me, there is an internal conversation of the questioner questioning me as I write. So there's sometimes dumb questions, but sometimes they're good questions too.
Of course, of course. And I was hoping to get to that idea of like, I write to find out what I'm thinking, because I read that a year or two ago from you, and that like completely transformed the way I thought about writing. I really thought, I guess I was raised or grew up thinking that writers were the experts who, now I have this piece of knowledge, now I need to just put it in a book and share it with the world. And I love your idea of exploring your ideas within the book.
Yeah, the thing about that might have actually been true, 50 years ago or something. But the thing now is that information is actually a commodity. I mean, you can ask Google all kinds of information, the facts. Facts are sort of a commodity. Where this kind of questioning and delving and exploring is useful is because most of what we need right today is actually not facts. It's context. It's something that's personalized to us. It's difference. It's seeing the world in a different way. It's the lateral approach to something. And those are, and so when I'm writing, say, something, it isn't so much about the facts, it's the interpretation, it's the view, it's the sensibility, it's all these other things that we kind of need as much as we need the facts, and in some cases need more in order to understand the facts. So understanding is a little bit broader than just having the facts. And that's where this trick, so to speak, of trying to see it in a different way, at least in my own way, is very valuable, because unless they can see it my way, it doesn't make sense to write it down. It doesn't make sense to explain it. It won't even connect to somebody else. And so and that's true for making things too, by the way. I mean, it's like the only reason to make something is in a certain sense to make either something that doesn't exist or to make something that does exist in a different way. And both of those kind of require that, that level of exploration, of personalization, of authenticity, and all these other things that are all very related. And that requires kind of questioning yourself. It's like, do I really feel that way? Or is there some other thing I think about that? Or, how far can I go? That's sort of a cliche. People have done that. That's nothing new. So it's a conversation. And that's, so you could say writing is a kind of a conversation. You could, making something is a kind of a conversation. You're telling a story in some ways, but it's more than just telling it. You're conversing the story. And I think most artists kind of recognize that conversation. And I think these days, even most engineers would recognize that conversation.
Yeah, I think you're right. And is it like the scientific sort of approach then, where you're almost trying to disprove what you start off as a hypothesis when you sit down to write an essay for your blog? Or are you trying to disprove it, or are you trying to back it up?
Sometimes I don't even know what the thesis is before I start. So that's one thing. I mean, there's one thing is, is to even get to the thesis that you're trying to prove or disprove. It's like, when I start writing, I often have no idea even what my thesis is. I have no opinion about something. And then, at the end, I may write something and still not have it. And then it doesn't go very far. It's not very important. But if I come to have an opinion about it, then you get into this practice of what can I say to defend it? And what would other people, what would be the criticism of it? That second part of it, of kind of critiquing or arguing with yourself on the negative, is really, really difficult. Some people are better at that than others. I'm okay. I'm not really great. Someone like Darwin, kept entire notebooks of all these arguments against his own theory that he would then try to address. That is, you know, that's kind of lawyerly, but that's very thorough. And if you can do it, it's great. And you know, engineers have the same problem. A lot of people wind up having working with other people for that reason. It's because having someone else do it is a lot easier and sometimes even more fun if you have the right kind of person who is, you know, challenging you on all these things. So some people can self-challenge. It's tough, but you need to be challenged one way or the other. Either if you can't do it, then someone else needs to do it.
Yeah, fair enough. And you mentioned something interesting about, I mean, obviously that it's 2016 now and information and facts are a commodity. When you started writing, and then when you started writing, obviously on the internet, it wasn't that way. Like, you are one of the first people, I would think, who started to really write. And I think even sort of try and explain the internet and where it was going before it kind of really happened. So somebody starting now, do you still think they have the same opportunity to write and to be heard and to, like, to be able to fight with these ideas in front of a worldwide audience now?
Yeah, it's a really great question. So let me just address the first part was, you know, when I started writing, I actually learned to write online in 80, 81 on the bulletin boards. And it turned out that I had a very telegraphic style, which was suited very well to this new medium. But in fact, I worked, my very first job was working for a publication called the Holworth Catalog that was trying to overcome this lack of information, the lack of facts, this lack of access to facts that was really universal at the time. Let's say, you know, in the 70s. I mean, if you could visit a bookstore, the typical bookstore from a regular city, other than New York or San Francisco, if you went to a bookstore in an ordinary city of 1960, you would have been shocked because there was some bestsellers and that was it. There was nowhere near this cornucopia of books on how to make stuff, or, I mean, just the most esoteric thing that you would find in even an independent bookstore today, let alone one of the bigger chains. And getting information about anything at that time was, I mean, it was like impossible. Like, you think about the kind of information you get now. If there wasn't the internet, where would you get it from? And that was the issue then. It was so, so hard to get information. Even like, say you wanted some information on a celebrity, which is now like ubiquitous, where would you go? And so that transformation has really been a revolution, because now you have all the information you want anywhere, and you're kind of almost too much of it. And so the challenge for somebody writing now, to kind of address your second part of your question, is really being heard. I mean, back then, if you could get the information and then you could do the research, you had an audience because you had these big publications that had a huge demand for material and paid decent for it. But today it's the opposite, is that everybody can kind of generate writing. There's more writing being done now than ever before, but the audience for it, the audience and the business model for supporting it is at a premium. So the challenge for people today is to have an audience. And I wrote a piece, which is actually not in my book, The Inevitable, but it's on a blog, called 1,000 True Fans, which is this idea that the technology also gives a solution to that problem, which is if you have direct contact or direct relationships with your audience, you don't need a mass audience of millions. You need in the thousands, that maybe the tens of thousands at the most. That if you have a direct relationship with your audience and they pay you directly for your work, that you don't need a million. You don't need a mass audience. That you can find a niche. And so all the audiences are niche these days. And so the advice I would give for someone writing right now is, you know, gather your 1,000 true fans. True fans are people who will buy anything that you produce, whether it's the box set and the paperback, or the, you know, the signed copy, or they'll travel 200 miles to see you sing, whatever it is. And each one of those you have to earn. You have to bring on one by one, and you know their name, you know who they are, you have a relationship with them, but you need only thousands of them to make a living, not a fortune. And I think, so that's one of the things for people starting to make things is cultivate this, a smaller number. You don't need millions, but if you focus on this niche, the true fans, you can have an audience.
Yeah. I think, well, I know that you're absolutely right. And it was actually a bit, I don't know if surreal is the right word, but as you mentioned, the 1,000 true fans, because I mean, reading that a couple of years ago when it came out, it was huge to me and massive. And I didn't have an audience at that time. Now I'm talking to you, which to me is odd because you're saying it, but only because I now have an audience that is small, right, of true fans. Like, and there's probably 10,000 of them now. But, and I started not even, like you say, New York City, or if you were in one of those places in the 70s, like I, even in 2015, when I started from a tiny little city in Canada, like in the middle of nowhere. But it's still, obviously it's possible because here we are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Having this conversation around it.
Right.
So it's the idea of starting and the writing to find it. But you said you started writing on the internet back in 80, 81 on bulletin boards. And so somebody starting in 2016, I want to see if there's a way we can correlate this, because I'm sure when you, like in 80, 81, you in no way could foretell or plan out that you would be here in 2016,
no,
or where you were in 92, or.
No, I didn't even attempt to, I don't have a career plan in that way. I work by project. And so I definitely had no idea that I'd be here.
Were you always okay with that?
Yeah. I mean, it's just my temperament. I understand and I rejoice in the fact that there's, you know, people do it differently. And some people are very, my wife is actually she decided in high school what her career was going to be. And she just kind of, you know, pursued it in just one step after another, very logically, very, very planned, very deliberately. That's great. But that wasn't me. And so, I mean, I don't even plan my days ahead very much. And there's lots of people who kind of really, you know, design their days the night before and stuff. That's great. But that's not me. And so the wonderful thing about life is that it takes all kinds and there's room enough. And this is, to me, one of the virtues of technology is that we have increased options and choices, that we don't have to all approach it the same way, that each year we have more ways to live, more ways to do our thing, more ways to make stuff, more ways to start stuff. This is, you know, I mean, this is an incredible time to start things because it's, you have so many different options to do it wherever you are in the world. Some places, of course, are more, you know, have more advantages than others, but there's still increased advantages all over the world. And I think that's great. So, you know, I've read a long piece and I will repeat it because I really, really believe it, which is this is the best time in history ever to start something. You have so many choices. If you want to do something like start a restaurant, which has been done a gazillion times, that's fine. It's actually easier to start a restaurant now than ever before. It's not, you know, you're not doing anything new. It's a mom and pop thing. It's a family business. Okay. You have that option. You can do the old school. If you want to do something crazy and have a startup that has no office and you work out of remote areas, you can do that too. That's new. That's possible. And there's so many ways to start something or to, by the way, to join something else that's already been started. Not everything has to be started. There's plenty of really great things to do with other people. And I think that's what I'm kind of emphasizing a little bit more in these days, because there's so many people starting things. It's like, well, you don't have to do everything yourself. That's one thing that I wish I knew when I was younger, which is that I could hire really great people to work with me, let alone like founders. I mean, just like you can hire people to do almost anything you want and they're really good and they're not that expensive and they do a really great job and they're fun to work with and they would love to work with you. So that's another option.
Do you do that now?
Yeah. Yeah. And a cool tool. It was called Elance. It's called, I think, Upwork now.
It is.
We do that all the time for things. And you can have really high quality work done from programming to design to lawyering to editorial work, anything that can be specified, you can post and have somebody in the world do it while you're sleeping. And the speed is often one of the advantages of that, of working with that. And then often encounter someone that's so good that if you have enough work in that area, you just hire them. So it's a way of actually it's kind of a hiring system as well. So yeah, and you know, that's how you kind of leverage your own power and ideas, is by having more people work on them.
Yeah, that is the leverage and the scale of your ideas. So you mentioned, interestingly, the mom and pop and like sort of like the brick and mortar. And that's where I'm assuming, just because you've been at this game for so long and see the technology evolve and grow and change and, I mean, create industries and also destroy industries. But there's always been this discussion of that whole, like, mom and pop is going to be, that thing is going to be destroyed. That's not going to exist anymore. Is that still a viable? There's the 1,000 true fans, and then there's the big, right? There's the Gangnam Styles. And is there this middle ground that's still?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I said I can probably dig it up somewhere, but in the 90s, when Amazon was kind of like 98 and all through the 2000s, I said again and again and again that Amazon would eventually make a brick and mortar store. And I just went to visit their bookstore of all things in Seattle. That was inevitable from my perspective, because it's, you know, just like a bound book is a highly evolved instrument for maintaining your attention. And it has all these really cool design elements for a book. And I think a store is an incredibly highly refined thing to channel attention and interest. And that experience of picking things up and looking at them and trying them and sizing them and comparing them with others and the serendipity of just seeing them in the store is never going to go away. So that's a viable option. And we'll, you know, in 50 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, we'll still have stores. Of course, there'll be different things going on with them, and they'll be highly integrated with the online world and stuff. But a physical thing, yes. They just won't look like what we do. So you have to be innovative there. Same thing with restaurants. Of course, we're going to be going to places to eat. Yes, of course, you'll have instant food. You know, you press the button and there it is. And of course, you'll have food delivered to you. But the old options don't go away. They're just going to be reimagined. And same thing with family businesses. They aren't going to go away. They'll just be reimagined. So it's just the reimagining part that is the chore, the task. But I think that hard middle is, there will be little startups, and then there's the big, you know, monsters. But there's going to be so many little ones in the middle. They're always ignored. The hard middle is always ignored. But it forms the bulk of what fills our lives. You know, most, you go down to Main Street, most of those stores are just, they're medium-sized businesses that get no respect at all. But they're often very profitable.
It's true. Yeah, it's absolutely true. And they don't get the respect. I wonder, like, are we going to come back to a time where we do start? Like, it seems like we only respect that big, like the app that gets funded by VCs for $250 million and creates this big thing. And then it's kind of forgotten about next year. But it's that thing. And we don't respect the family that's passed on generations, this shoe store.
Right, exactly. The VCs actually have a term for it. They call it a lifestyle business. And the way I would say it's the difference between making a living versus making a fortune. So they hold their noses up to lifestyle businesses, which are just basically, it's a business that makes a living, because they want that scale. They want, so in their definition, a startup is something that has to be able to scale. The startup, the mom and pop startup, they're not interested in. And so part of this is a fashion thing right now. There's, you know, this hip to do a startup. And again, when people say startup now, they mean something that could scale. When I was growing up, it's really funny. I was like in the 60s, I became aware of this. If you told someone in the 60s that you were working at a startup or working on a startup, that was code for I'm unemployed. I mean, it was like, the sorriest of all people. I mean, the people who were so desperate that they couldn't get a job were the people who did a startup. That was like a penalty almost. That was punishment. There was no honor in that. There was no role models. There was completely considered like, you're either crazy or you're just desperate. And now, of course, everybody has a startup. And I think that that's the fashion because of the scaling. But once people realize that there's this other option, which is to make a living instead of a fortune, and you have these, then I think the idea of like, well, I'm going to work on a business that doesn't scale, it just makes me a livelihood. And there's that becomes honorable. I mean, that would be a nice change. I don't know if I'm not predicting that will happen. I'm saying that's an option. That's a scenario that could happen because there are a huge, most businesses are these middle size things and they can be very successful and they can produce a living for people. And maybe we'll come to honor that.
Yeah. And even if we don't, it doesn't make it less viable.
Right.
It absolutely truly is. And it's becoming more so every minute. So you work project by project. I love that you really sort of like this idea of the lifestyle business. It seems like you kind of stuck to that where you are the business and you've worked project to project. Obviously, at this point, Kevin, if you wanted to, you could come up with an idea and get VC funding and go the big route if you wanted. But that's neither here nor there necessarily. But as projects and working project to project, how do you right now, Kevin, when an idea comes through your inbox or through your head, whether it's a new book or just a new thing you want to start, what is it, an internal process or like a written process you have? But how do you determine what is worth your time, energy, and resources right now?
Right. So the first thing I try to do is I try to give the idea away. I try to, as much as possible, I'll talk about it and I will try to give it away or try to have someone else do it. Because there's also lots of things that I think are really cool that I would like, that I would like someone else to do because it's, you know, it's like, I want this. So I'm telling you, I have this idea and maybe you'll do it. And that'd be great because then I can use it or have it or whatever. So that's the first process is I like to talk about the things that I'm thinking about doing or working on in the hopes that someone else would come along and say, oh, I just did that or so-and-so did that. And then I say, that's good. I don't have to do that one. And so the second thing is if I can't give it away. So I try to give it away. And then if it keeps coming back and no one will do it, then it's like, oh, I guess I have to do that one. And then it would be like, well, the second step of that is, and this I got from Stuart Brand, which is that he observed, because he kind of lived his life project-wise, was that any project that you're kind of worth doing that you do is going to be 5 years from the time you first think of it to the time you abandon it. And so then the question is, well, you know, it's going to be 5 years. Do I want to spend 5 years on this? Is this, because I don't have that many 5-year projects left. And I'm only able to do kind of one real project at a time. And so you kind of count like, well, you know, that's got to really matter. And the question that I'm asking myself in terms of, you know, do I want to do this is really these days has come down to, well, I have to enjoy it, but that's not enough. It has to pay, which is not enough. The main thing, the main criteria is, can anybody else do it? Am I the only one that can do it? Can I? Because if there's nobody else who can do it, then that's the one I want to do. Because that means that it's going to be me. It's going to be something that nobody else can do. I'm the only one who can do it. And so that's the things I have to do. And so the process of kind of giving away is really a process of trying to winnow out and get down to the things that only I could do. If I'm going to do a podcast, it's going to be a podcast that only I would ever do. Other people should think it's a bad idea. Other people should think it's stupid. It's, you know, it has to be something that I'll be the only one to do it that way. And so that's really, really hard. And it's really hard to get there when you're young because you don't know what those things are. It kind of takes, well, you do these projects in order to find out what it is that only you can do. And so it's you know, some of the things I've done, other people could have done, but I didn't know that at the time. And so as I get older, I have a little bit better idea, but I'm not always right. And so that's the kind of criteria that I'm looking at is could someone else do this?
Nice. And I agree. I've kind of started calling it like maturing to know. It seems like the younger we are, the more we say yes to everything and every mm-hmm. idea and opportunity. And as we grow and evolve as, creators of things, we realize we can't say yes to everything. And plus more opportunities come.
Exactly. Right. And so, so maturing to know N-O instead of N-W, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So you say no more often, but you still have to, saying no is still something you have to learn, which ones to say no to. That's the hard part. So yes, I think that is a sense of both success and maturing. I mean, the thing about success though is success is really can be a prison, because the more successful you are, the harder it is to risk everything. You get kind of trapped by doing things well. So if your success is based on expertise and excellence, then it's really hard to do something that's not excellent, to do something that's crappy. But that's often kind of what you have to do to move to the next highest point. You have to go down a little bit. And going down, the more excellent you are, the more difficult that becomes. And so that's the second challenge for maturing, which is saying no, but also learning to say yes to something where you are going to be a complete newbie, disaster, unexcellent, a failure, and a dummy. And so that is, having real failure is the thing that becomes more difficult as you learn to say no.
Right. As a culture, like from the West perspective, like North America, obviously we've really embraced being wrong, though, and that whole failure.
To some extent, but and that's compared to, say, the Chinese or other, some Orientals, which are still learning how to embrace failure. Yes, I think culturally we have a higher tolerance, but believe me, when you are someone who does things with excellence, it is still very hard to let that go.
Yeah, maybe it just makes great blog posts. The idea sure. of failure and growth from it.
Yeah.
But not necessarily. And this idea of everything needing to be sort of better. And when you reach this certain level, obviously it is harder, right? You write a book and the next one should hopefully sell more. Your blog post should get shared yeah. more. Your ideas should go further each right. time. And that probably does make it harder. But this has been a lot of fun, Kevin. I want to wrap up just on this one. It kind of works into this final question. This idea I'm working with calling the entrepreneurial gap. So as creators and makers of things, we tend to, I think, live in this gap where it doesn't matter where we've come from and how far we've journeyed. And you've come a long ways. We still, as dreamers, are always projecting our success into the future. So we kind of live in this gap where, like the horizon, the further you walk towards it, it always gets further away. From the outside, we look absolutely successful. But from ourselves, it's always in 1 month when you hit that goal, in 3 months when you hit that goal, which I agree we need. But we know as right before we hit that goal, we're going to set bigger ones into the future. So Kevin, you've had a lot of wins, a lot of losses, I'm sure, highs and lows through your massive and extraordinary career. But I would love it if you could stop and turn and look behind you and tell me how you feel about the whole journey up until today.
Oh my gosh. I try to live with kind of regret minimization, meaning that I really try to live with, so I don't have major regrets. And that's fortunately been true, that I have very few regrets about how the journey went. And particularly since I wasn't planning it, wasn't really trying to steer it in any way. What else would I say about it? I mean, so I'll say one thing about it, which is, there's another element of it, which is I was very lucky. I was lucky in many ways, not just in terms of being born in a particular country at a particular time with peace and prosperity, but also lucky in more particulars about things that I was interested in, being present at the right time, at the right place, through no large scale design of my own. You know, for instance, Wired was, we were lucky with Wired. If you started, I'd tried something a couple of years earlier. It didn't really work. So it was, timing was, we were fortunate to have done it at the right time. If you'd done it even a couple of years earlier, of course, a couple of years later, it wouldn't have had the same impact. So there's an element of luck that I don't want to gloss over, because I think a lot of the people who have been successful, it isn't just only work. I think hard work and smarts, I think there is an element of luck. And I'm just being honest by saying that I was lucky, as well as all the other things that we try to do in our lives. And so I think you can prepare for it, for sure. I think you can prepare for luck, and you can, I think the usual wisdom of advice of, like, well, trying to make as much luck as you can, which is, you know, as many opportunities for luck to come, I think that's also good. But there's still, I look back, and this is your question prompted, I look back and I realize I was lucky as well.
Beautiful answer, Kevin. I absolutely appreciate it.
Sure thing.
So you have a brand new book called The Inevitable. I would love it right now if you could take a moment to tell the listener about the book.
So The Inevitable is a look at the next 20 to 30 years in technology, mostly digital technology, and what the long-term trends are, the long-term bending, the long-term leaning. It's almost like gravity that is pulling water down a valley. The path of that drop as it goes down is completely unpredictable, but the fact that it's going to go down is pretty inevitable. And that's what I'm talking about, these kind of large-scale trends. And I enumerate 12 of them, 12 categories, and they're all verbs. They're all motions in process. And there are things like, we're going to have increased sharing, we're going to have increased tracking, we're going to have increased cognifying, which is making things smarter. And all these things are pretty inevitable in their larger form. The products are not, the specifics are not, and the specifics and the particulars are what we have control over, and they make a difference to us. So, like, telephones were inevitable. The iPhone was not. The internet was inevitable. Twitter was not. We have choices about how we make the internet, and they make a big difference to us. But it's only by embracing these large-scale trends, like increasing AI, increasing virtuality, that we can actually steer it in the particulars. And so my message in general is that all this stuff is coming. We can't stop it. We can't outlaw it. We can't use regulations to stop it. We need to embrace it, and by embracing it, we can actually steer it in the particulars. So that's what it's about. It's about, you know, all the things you're kind of hearing, virtual reality coming. What does it mean to us? AI, what does it mean? How does it work? Tracking, new attention standards will probably be paid for our attention as well as paying for it. I mean, total tracking, that's coming too. It's about the next 20 or 30 years in technology.
I love it. The Inevitable, understanding the 12 technological forces that will shape our future. And you can find out all about Kevin and his work at kk.org, O-R-G. I will link to the book. A bunch of things that we mentioned in passing, Kevin, about things that you've written. 1,000 True Fans is the best time in history. And I'll link to all those in the show notes for everybody. Once again, Kevin, thank you so much for taking the time to join me and for sharing so honestly. And please just keep doing what you're doing.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Kevin, thank you so much for joining me. That was a really, really, really fun conversation. You're somebody I've wanted to talk to for a long time. And I don't like to admit this, but I still do get a little bit nervous, anxious, uneasy sometimes for a few people that I still get to talk to. And Kevin was one that a person that I really, really admire. I admire his writing, his work, what he's accomplished and what he's sort of put out into the world and in the way he's done it. And I don't know, I didn't want to be that guy asking dumb questions, you know? But Kevin made it easy for me. Kevin, I think, made me look fairly good. And he shared a lot of really, really, truly insightful things. I admire and like his project-to-project lifestyle and his admiration for lifestyle businesses over massive scale businesses, but the idea of just using the internet and the power and leverage it can give you to do things like the 1,000 true fans that he talks about, and the idea that there are no gatekeepers anymore if we want to. I mean, he's successfully self-published books as well as traditionally published books and creating his own projects for profit and not for profit. And I really admire it. It's a great path to follow, and I'm glad we got to really sort of discuss that career path that he's chosen. So this conversation was a little bit longer than usual, and we went to some different places, but it was really, really enjoyable and insightful for me to listen to Kevin. So I have a ton of notes here that I had to go through, and so I had to go back and listen. And there was about 10 things I needed to go back and listen to that I had marked down on the first time through. So I went back and listened, and then I went back and listened again. And then I went back one more time and listened through the conversation. And that last time through, there was something Kevin said that was so very, very clear to me. It was that one thing that Kevin said. Did you get it? Did you hear it? Let's do it. Let's find the hack.
And this I got from Stuart Brand, which is that he observed, because he kind of lived his life project-wise, was that any project that you kind of worth doing that you do is going to be 5 years from the time you first think of it to the time you abandon it. And so then the question is, well, you know, is this, that's five, it's going to be 5 years. Is what, do I want to spend 5 years on this? Is this, because I don't have that many 5 year projects left.
And that's the hack. Kevin, thank you for this. If there's not one of the hardest parts or aspects of being an entrepreneur, being a creator of things, it's deciding on what projects to execute on, which ones to start, how to know you're not avoiding the whole shiny object nonsense and distracting yourself. This is it. This is absolutely it. From Stuart Brand to Kevin Kelly, we can trust that this is a safe, fair, well-established, and thought-out process. 5 years. Seems like a long time. Seems like a really long time. But it makes perfect sense. I mean, I'm thinking of Hack the Entrepreneur now as just becoming something. And it's been 2 years I've been doing it. And I see no end in sight, meaning that it is easily going to take me to 5 years out. And it was a project worth doing. And it seems like a long time, as I said, the 5 years, but if it's worth doing, it's going to take 5 years. And it's wrong to kid yourself or to try and fool yourself into thinking that it will only take 6 months or a year. Because if it really is worth doing for you and for the people you are creating said project for, and then to really market it or get behind it long enough for it to grow and sort of mature into what it needs to, it will take 5 years. Next time you're sitting down with your notebook and coming up with ideas of things to work on next, think of this 5-year sequence. Some of us have more time for 5-year project sequences. Depending on our age, we might have more, we might have less, but we all have a very finite amount of time, amount of energy, amount of resources, and amount of projects that we are able to accomplish from this point forward. I think that it's fooling yourself if you don't want to take this advice of Kevin's, because this, and it's not even advice, it's what he does, but it's, to me, it's the insight. It's really, really smart, and it really clarifies and adds like a default sort of no to a lot of projects, which is the hard thing to do, is to learn to say no to these projects. Now you just know that, well, I'm not going to be interested in that e-commerce business or that website or that newsletter, whatever it is you want to start. I would not be interested in that in 5 years. It's just a flash in the pan. You're doing it for the wrong reasons. You're even thinking of doing it for the wrong reasons. Put this time span on it. 5 years. Will you still be interested in wanting to work on it then? Then move to the next step and see if it's going to be viable for you. I love it. Thank you so much, Kevin. Thank you for sharing and thank you for joining me. All right. That was a lot of fun. I appreciate so much that you stopped by again. We are now back at full steam ahead. Regular schedule, Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, publishing every single week. I look forward to hanging out with you more. Look forward to, you know, spending more time together. Track me down on Twitter if you want, at John Naster, or email me, john@hacktheentrepreneur. If you have anybody you've stumbled across and you would love to hear them on the show, by all means, drop me an email. And yeah, I'll give them a look, see if we can work something out. Could be fun, or just drop me an email. Tell me what's up. Tell me how your summer's going. Why not? All right, this has been fun. I appreciate you so much for taking the time today. I know there's a lot of choices for podcasts out there. But you, me, and Hack the Entrepreneur are now back in full swing. So, you know, you don't have to waste time with those other ones. All right, it's been fun. Thank you so very much. And please, until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.